So let me carry on then. The third judgment which I have for you is again UK. I have no idea. I didn't choose the cases because of the country. It just happens there's quite a lot of references from UK courts on free movement and related issues. And watch out, there will be more because under the withdrawal agreement, UK courts can still send references for a number of years after Brexit on interpretation of the part two of the withdrawal agreement, which is movement rights. So this time the reference was actually not from Great Britain, but it was from Northern Ireland, from a court of appeal. And the case is called Bargjetari. The plaintiff was of Albanian nationality. Oh, the family was of Albanian nationality. The family story is quite complicated indeed, and let me explain how people can complicate their lives. So the applicant, as I said, is an Albanian lady, Bargjetari, who was married to an Albanian chap who was residing in the United Kingdom. Now, the thing was that Mr. Bargjetari was residing as a spouse of an EU national, of a British national. So now you're probably confused whether he was bigamist, and at the same time, in relationship with a UK national and with an Albanian national, or perhaps we've missed whether Albania joined the EU in the meantime. Well, it hasn't, and it's planning to, hoping to start accession negotiations only this year. So what happened was that Mr. Bargjetari was involved in a relationship with a British lady, and under UK immigration rules, he had the right to reside in the United Kingdom. Now, that relationship ended in 2011. His residence card was not revoked. Then he met his future spouse of Albanian nationality. They flew to Tirana, got married, and went back to Northern Ireland. What the British authorities missed was that he was no longer allowed to have that particular type of residence card, and they didn't notice that for 3 years. So much for efficiency of the Home Office. So he was therefore, in a way, illegally residing in Northern Ireland. Now, he was working. He was working in a restaurant, in a car wash place. He was genuinely earning money, feeding his new family, which in the meantime, from two expanded to five, so three small kids. He was paying taxes. He was paying social insurance. And no one noticed that he was illegally in the country. So his work, well, he was, in terms of substance of the work, he was not doing anything illegal. It's just that he didn't have the right to work. And now, bonus, two of the three children were Irish. And that makes things very complicated. I should explain some basics of the rules that apply in the Republic of Ireland. If we have a colleague from the Republic of Ireland, I'll be grateful later. No, we don't. Okay. Because I wanted to say that if I get something wrong, I'll be happy to be corrected. So, but my understanding is that if you have a child who is born in Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, at least for now, that child can acquire Irish nationality, which was explored a few years, well, a decade back by a Chinese family and so on and so forth. So this is what happened. We had children who were born in Northern Ireland, but so part of the United Kingdom, but they acquired Irish nationality. So without moving anywhere, they actually were beneficiaries of Directive 2004/38 because they were EU migrating citizens, Irish nationals residing in Northern Ireland, which technically is part of a different country. Clever, I'd say. Now, but then the problem started because Mrs. Bargjetari wanted to legalize house stay as a parent of EU migrating citizen. So the children, Of course, in such case, she could only rely on the general right of residence. Children, for obvious reasons, cannot be workers or self-employed. So she had to prove that she had financial resources, that they had health insurance, and that they were not relying on any benefits. They were not a burden to the social system of the country. And that's when suddenly, no surprises here, the Home Office started to have particular interest in Mr. Bhargatari's right to reside in the United Kingdom. And so did the Irish authorities, which started the procedure of depriving the children of the nationality. Now, the details are here quite vague in the both in the judgments of the Court of Justice and the opinion of Advocate General Spooner. Now, the Irish authorities actually took the decision to annul the citizenship, the Irish citizenship, of the two children that she wanted to derive her rights from. However, they requested judicial review of the decisions, and the case was pending when the reference was submitted to the Court of Justice in the main case. Not surprisingly, the British government said, well, they are no longer Irish nationals, and therefore this reference is devoid of purpose, because simply she cannot now, if the children are no longer Irish but are Albanian, she cannot derive the free movement rights from her. And that's basically game over. Now, the Court of Justice rejected that argument. The court says, well, to the best of our knowledge, first of all, the judicial review of the nationality decisions, is citizenship decisions, is pending in the Irish court. And second of all, we, as the Court of Justice, we are bound by whatever the national court tells us. And we haven't heard from the High Court anything as to their desire, for instance, to withdraw the reference. So for us, the case still stands. We're going to take a look at that. And one of the key issues here, and that's what the Irish court asked the Court of Justice to decide, was whether she did comply with this general condition of having financial resources. Obviously, the children themselves were not earning money. And the question was whether financial resources could include the income of Mr. Bhargatari, despite the fact that he was illegally in the United Kingdom, and therefore he was working illegally, even though his activities were perfectly legal from the substantive point of view. He was not involved in any criminal activity whatsoever. So the question was, what does it mean in Directive 2004/38, paragraph 7.1, that you need to have financial resources? The exact words are sufficient resources for the EU citizens themselves and the family members. Well, it's not difficult to imagine that the position of the Home Office was, well, you cannot count that money simply because he was illegally in the country and therefore working illegally for a period of time. The Court of Justice did not agree with such reasoning. The court says, quote, the Advocate General, first of all, says that those resources are provided from income derived from the activity unlawfully carried on in that member state without residence, work or work permit by the child's father and national of that country. So this falls, according to Advocate General, under the requirement of Article 7.1b of the directive. What the Advocate General took into account, and the court then agreed with the Advocate General, was that the authorities should not take a decision which would be automatic. The decision has to be proportionate, and it has to take into account a number of facts, that first of all, he genuinely worked, that he was paying taxes, that he was paying national insurance contributions, and that money was used to feed the family, including the children from whom the mother now wanted to derive her right to reside. So the Court of Justice, agreeing with the Advocate General, says, well, Article 7.1b doesn't specify where the money has to come from. And it's obvious that if you have a child that is the primary right holder, like here potentially, then obviously the child cannot earn the money. So someone else provides the money that would then help to get this general right to reside, which in their case was problematic anyhow, but that was not subject of the case because they didn't have a comprehensive health insurance within the understanding of the Home Office. So that was pretty much the conclusion. So for the general right to reside, you need to meet these three criteria. And as far as the money is concerned, it is not required that the money must be, for instance, earned by the primary right holder. It may be provided, like here, by parents. And the fact that Mr. Bargettari was working illegally at the time in the UK, but the work itself was legal and he was complying with all the requirements of the tax law, that made the funding sort of tick the box for sufficient resources for residents. Bit convoluted, the whole case, the whole story, but definitely very interesting indeed. And this is also linked to the final case that I have for you for this morning. Let me just take it, there we are, which is the case called RH, which is the promised Spanish case. Now, this one is very interesting indeed, and it follows a very controversial line of jurisprudence, which started about 10 years ago, perhaps less, with a controversial case, Ruiz Zambrano. I see a few of you nodding, so I suppose you're familiar with Zambrano. Is everyone familiar with Zambrano? Just nod. No? No? Okay, so there'll be a bit of recap for Ilona and for others, perhaps something new. So, to cut a long story short, free movement rights, free movement of persons rights, as a matter of principle, apply when we have the cross-border element. So you have an EU citizen migrating to another member state, as I mentioned, residing for up to 3 months without any formalities, having to comply with any formalities. Then someone has to be a worker, self-employed, or benefit from the general right to reside. And then after 5 years of meeting the criteria, you automatically benefit from the permanent right to reside. Now, the general right to move and reside is laid down in Article 21 of the TFEU, the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which deals with citizenship rights. And then a reminder, separately, workers are regulated in Article 45, 49, that's self-employed right of establishment. But the question is, and was in Zambrano, to what extent someone who has never moved, never exercised the free movement rights, to what extent someone is then still protected as an EU citizen, and to what extent, for instance, the third country national may derive from that non-migrating EU citizen, derive the right to reside. Now, it will sound less complicated if I give you the facts of Zambrano. So Ruiz Zambrano, we moved to Belgium. We have two Colombian nationals, parents, who are residing in Belgium. They arrived 10 years prior and received political asylum. They could not go back to Colombia without risking their lives. Now, Mr. Zambrano worked, was paying taxes, everything was fine. The thing was that the Belgian immigration authorities were not really checking whether the family still had the right to reside in Belgium. In the meantime, they had two children who were Belgian citizens. Now, the trouble started when Mr. Zambrano lost his job and asked for financial assistance of the state. And it was at this stage when the Belgian authorities started to get terrible interest in his status in Belgium. And they said, well, you can't get the benefits. We will eventually want to deport you back to Colombia. It is safe now. Hang on a minute. But there are two minors, two children who are Belgian nationals. So obviously, if the parents were to be deported to Colombia, that would mean that the children would be deported. So you would be deporting EU citizens from their own country. Now, not surprisingly here, the Belgian court sent a reference for preliminary ruling to the Court of Justice, basically asking, you know, what next? Now, the court rendered one of its most important judgments of the last 20 years, and one of the most criticized judgments in the same vein. Not necessarily for the conclusion, because the conclusion seems sound, but you have no idea where the conclusion comes from, because there's hardly any reasoning in the judgment. There's literally, I think, 8 paragraphs of reasoning, and it just doesn't wash. Clearly, the Grand Chamber was very much divided in terms of what to do. And most controversially, the court says that Mr. and Mrs. Zambrano should have the right to reside in Belgium, because if they were to be deported, that would deprive the children of the, and I quote, genuine enjoyment of their rights as EU citizens. That's, of course, like this. And the court relies here not on Article 21, which guarantees free movement rights, but it relies on Article 20 of the treaty, which simply says that nationals of member states have automatically EU citizenship. So they are automatically ex lege national citizens of the European Union. So the immediate reaction was, where did this come from? I personally asked in public, so I can repeat it, the Advocate General in this case, Advocate General Sharpstone, who delivered a fantastic opinion. I said, did they follow you? And she looked at me and says, Adam, Advocate General in the case is telling you that she has no clue whether she was followed or not and where it came from. Not surprisingly, the court received quite a number of references still from national courts, basically asking, and what exactly do you mean? What are we supposed to do with it? I had a colleague at the law school at the time who was a judge in the immigration tribunal, and every time he passed me by in the hallway at the university, he would say, Zambrano. Well, it's not my fault. It's the court, it's not me. Anyway, the trouble was, of course, you know, what does it mean, genuine enjoyment of the rights? Does it apply only to children? Was it because children's life was at stake, potentially, that they would be deported? And it's also a paradox in this case, because goods have more rights than people. If you think about it, it sounds probably absurd, but if you look at judgment Dassonville, where we have a definition of measures having equivalent effect, it says all trading rules which hinder trade actually or potentially. So the goods physically do not have to cross the borders for traders to trigger Article 34. Well, here, if you put it all together, for instance, with cases like Carpenter, the question is, what if Zambranos were going once a month to Disneyland in France, and the children therefore were receivers of services? That should trigger the right, because of course, deportation to Colombia would deprive them of the right to go to Disneyland. So all this case law is just a bit crazy, but also shows the weakness of the citizenship. As such, on the one hand, the court says that citizenship is such an important status, but on the other hand, something doesn't add up here. And the RH case, which I will now discuss, it builds on Zambrano, and also not only because of EU law, but also because of Spanish law and the interpretation of the Spanish law by the Supreme Court of Spain. So the facts are as follows. We have a Spanish national residing in Spain who has never exercised her movement rights. She's lived pretty much all her life in Spain. And then in 2015, she marries a chap from Morocco. According to the file of the case, the legality of marriage not called into question. Genuine people fall in love, they do. So there's no risk here that this is an arranged marriage to give the Moroccan chap the right to live in Spain. In turn, he applies for a temporary residence card, watch out, as a family member of a union citizen. But the trouble is that this union citizen is not a migrating EU citizen. She is in her own country. So that doesn't fall under the Directive 2004/38, which in Article 3, Paragraph 1, says that this directive, the beneficiaries, are those who move and reside in other member states. And the court in Zambrano, for instance, interpreted that very strictly, said, well, directive doesn't apply, Zambrano family never moved. Now, so where is the problem? The problem is Article 7 of the decree, of Spanish Royal Decree, which deals with the movement rights of EU migrating citizens. It's basically a transposition instrument for Directive 2004/38. And it says, like the directive, that all union citizens and nationals of other states which are parties to the EEA agreement, for instance, have the right to reside in Spain for over 3 months. And then, apart from status of work, etc., we have a carbon copy of Article 7 of the directive. So anyone who has sufficient resources and the family, neither the person nor the family members are burdened to the social assistance system, and they have comprehensive sickness insurance, they have the right to reside. Now, if you read those provisions just as they are translated by the court and copy-pasted into the judgment, you will think, okay, well, what does it have to do with this case? Because this clearly applies to EU migrating citizens, right? So this is not the case here. Ah, here is the hook. The Supreme Court of Spain, in its jurisprudence, ruled that this provision applies equally to family reunification if you have a Spanish national and a third country national. So basically, interpretation of the Spanish Supreme Court was the same rules would apply to EU migrating citizens as they do to apply to Spanish nationals, which is, you know, possible. You can do it this way. Then, of course, you go beyond the scope of the directive. This is then simply a legal transplant, so to speak. And this stands in stark contrast with what you have, for instance, in the UK, where it's much more difficult, was much more difficult for a UK national to bring a spouse from a third country than for an EU national to bring a spouse from a third country, which is, you know, extreme. So then on the top of that, we need to add provisions of the Civil Code of Spain. Article 68, I quote, spouses shall be obliged to live together and shall owe each other loyalty and mutual assistance. In addition, they must share domestic responsibilities and care for ascendants and descendants and the other dependents. Now, this proved to be important in this case. I should add that the couple resides with the father-in-law. They live together with the father of the Spanish lady. So what happens? This Moroccan chap applies, and the Spanish authorities automatically reject his application, saying, you don't have financial resources required. That's it. They did not take into account any other factors. They did not take into account, for instance, levels of dependence between the wife and the husband. And they didn't take into account that the father of the bride was very generous and said, well, I have financial resources, no problem at all. I will give you the money to prove that you have financial resources. There's no problem at all. They will not be relying on social assistance in any possible way. They requested judicial review of that decision. And the first instance court upheld that decision. Now, That court ruled that Article 7 of the Royal Decree was not applicable to family members of Spanish nationals, which was contravention of the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court of Spain. And therefore, the state administration itself appealed to the Supreme Court. So one thing led to another, and reference arrived at the Court of Justice, asking whether Article 20 of the Treaty of TFEU, so the same provision as in Zabrana, why is it because the Spanish spouse was dependent on the Moroccan chap, and he was to be deported, she would be deported as well. She would have to, not deported, but she would have to leave potentially the European Union as well. And that would deprive her of genuine enjoyment of her rights as an EU citizen. And also the question was whether the civil code, the provision which I quoted on the marriage and obligations of the spouses, whether that was potentially in breach of Article 20 as well, because if she were he were to be deported and she were to follow or not follow him, that potentially could be in breach of the civil code, because they would not be living together, sharing life together. Now the second question was answered in the negative. The Court of Justice said, well, this would be really really a stretch indeed, and Spanish law doesn't require people to live together to comply with the civil code. However, the judgment quite painstakingly goes into Article 20 and whether it precludes decisions of that kind. And the court, Justice Advocate General Pikme, the Estonian Advocate General, the court concludes that Article 20 precludes such practices like the administrative authorities in Spain. The decisions cannot be automatic. Indeed, factors need to be taken into account. It precludes such decisions only if there is a relationship of dependency of such nature that it would lead the Union citizen being compelled to accompany the third country national, leave the European Union, and therefore be deprived of the genuine enjoyment of the rights. The decision has to be proportionate, obviously, has to take into account fundamental rights, the right to family life. So what we see from this judgment is also follow up not only Zambrano, but also some other cases, that the court gives this very generous interpretation of Article 20 in such extreme cases. Obviously, the easiest solution for them would be to simply move to another country, say Portugal, work for a couple of years, and then, of course, the Moroccan husband would have the rights derived from the spouse migrating EU citizen, and then she could bring him back to Spain after a period of time as a former worker or former self-employed, someone, a former migrating EU citizen.